I think the thing to flag is Altice International has a lot of the same flexibility that Altice France has.
Is, do you mean in terms of the unrestricted?
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of that is both of those builder baskets go back to 2012 and 2014, respectively. And so they've both accumulated quite a lot of buildup.
Hello, and welcome to Cloud9Fin, a podcast on all things leveraged finance. We follow corporate debt from issuance to redemption, credits from performing to distressed, and everything in between. I'm Dan Alderson, an editor at 9Fin, and your host for this podcast.
Hi, I'm Freddie Doust, a restructuring consultancy lawyer at 9Fin, sitting in the legal team.
Hi, I'm Chris Osborne. I'm part of the legal team here as well, covering more of the bonds on a primary and secondary basis.
And I'm Nathan Mitchell, a distressed credit analyst here at 9Fin.
On March the 20th, Altice management shocked the debt market with a threat. Take a haircut and write off large amounts of debt in Altice France, or lose out on the proceeds from the sale of assets the company has cleverly designated as unrestricted subsidiaries. We want to get quickly into this, get to the punchy stuff, but I think we should start with a top-line view on what's been happening and how we got here. And for people who are catching up with, which is all of us, because it's a fast-moving situation. There are some uncomfortable knowns and even more uncomfortable unknowns about what's happening with Altice. So let's start with the knowns. Maybe I'll come to you, Nathan.
Sure. So as you say, a couple of weeks ago, management basically gave creditors of Altice France an ultimatum. You either participate in the stress exchange, which will see your debt haircut and trimmed on the principal amounts, or you will not see the proceeds from the asset sales that were moved to the unrestricted subsidiaries. It's interesting because prior to the call, the expectation was that asset sales within Altice France's restricted group and potentially asset sales in the sister company Altice International would be helped to deleverage Altice France by itself. But this is seen as an aggressive move by Drahi himself and management Altice France to help the group achieve its deleveraging target down to four turns.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just jumping in here, Nathan, off of what you've said, you know, one of the things that's really interesting here is, and we won't go into too much of the technicalities here, but the way they designated Altice Media as an unrestricted subsidiary, we calculate that they have quite a significant amount of capacity to do that again for other subsidiaries. And, you know, we've put out some pieces recently that go into some of those technicalities. But I think the main point here is they have this basically in their arsenal to do again. Kind of where those implications are, I think there's probably three main primary uses that we see for Altice France if they were to designate future subsidiaries or assets as unrestricted in addition to Altice Media. Is one, dividends. Basically, are some of these going to come out of the group? Two, they do an asset sale, but they've designated as unrestricted. And in effect, those proceeds are free to use to how they want to delever other debt in the group without being subject to the asset sale proceeds covenant. So it gives them a little more flexibility to look to do tender offers below par, or go after unsecured debt instead of secured debt, that type of thing. And I think then the third bucket is even just designating some of these subsidiaries as unrestricted, apart from any sort of asset sale, still would allow them for some potential priming or up-tiering transactions. So that kind of sets the stage for, I think, then how we maybe want to talk about some of those. I think, Freddie, there's probably also a few other things to lay the groundwork as well, just in terms of how that impacts some of what we know.
You mean in terms of director's duties, et cetera?
Yeah, I think just in terms of, you know, how do those three things kind of play against each other of, you know, we can probably put using the proceeds for any deleveraging or any sort of up-tiering transaction to the side, but maybe it's worth jumping in first, you know, are dividends here a real option?
Yeah, so this is kind of one of the elements, I think, which is quite interesting from a restructuring perspective. So as Chris said, there's significant capacity for the group to kind of effectively do what they want in terms of asset sale proceeds. So the question is, in that context, what can bondholders kind of hang their hat on to limit future leakage, in particular in the context of kind of dividend and other distributions to shareholders? And I think in that context, the real question, the real thing to kind of think about is director's duties, compliance, and antecedent transaction risk. So just digging into those super quick. So I think in terms of director's duties, the first thing to consider is, you know, is there an obligation for directors to file at, you know, the present time? And secondly, have directors entered into transactions which they shouldn't have? And that's all in the context of French law, because, you know, the relevant entities here are French. I think the high level takeaway is that there's by no means certain guardrails for the bondholders to rely on in this context, and there's not really a huge amount of protection afforded to them from directors' duties. But I think creditors should be aware of the relevant considerations. So just kind of stepping through those super quick, in the context of failure to file, suspension of payments, in France, there is an obligation to file for insolvency within 45 days of the occurrence of suspension of payments, which roughly translates in the context of kind of UK law to cash flow insolvency. The reason this is important is because if the relevant debtors are viewed to be insolvent, then that can be used as a stick by creditors to drive an outcome. And secondly, because it will form the basis for determining whether the business is insolvent and therefore whether hardening periods apply, and therefore there's antecedent transaction antecedent transaction risk. So really the key point here is hardening periods, right? So if, for example, assets have been transferred out, which as we say is permitted, and then a distribution is made, the question really is, was that done during the hardening period and therefore is it vulnerable to clawback? The hardening period in France is...
And Freddie, sorry to interrupt, but I think one of the things just to clarify a bit, right, is, you know, when we talk about transferring some of these assets out as an unrestricted, you know, we kind of have two groups here, right? We've got the restricted group, and then we've got like the broader insolvency group. And the point a little bit I think you're making is you know, designated some of these as an unrestricted, they're still part of this broader insolvency group. It's then if the directors are taking some type of action like a dividend, where now there are, you know, real assets here, the cash, kind of quote unquote coming out of the insolvency group then, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, so I suppose it's a question of whether on the basis of them having said that, that therefore means that there's a concession that they are in effect insolvent now or might be in the future. What it certainly does do is it makes entering into these kind of, you know, transactions which might be characterized in the future as being antecedent transactions or kind of clawbackable transactions much harder to do with a straight face as a director.
Yeah, but Freddie, so, and Nathan, maybe jump in and correct me, but I believe on the earnings call, right, they kind of highlighted that they were going to be short of cash and people are going to need to take some haircuts, which is part of what kickstarted that. Does that weigh into this if the company's already conceding this?
Yes, certainly. I think, as Freddie was saying, it's not a slam dunk, but I think it adds for a really interesting dynamic between the pull and push between creditors and Drahi himself. You know, it's fairly widely accepted that on a valuation basis, value breaks in the secured, the unsecured debt is underwater. So it's quite interesting that Drahi is expecting creditors to basically take the hit and for him not to lose any of his equity. So for example, with unsecured especially, they can either take the discounted exchange, whether that's a discounted buyback or some form of exchange. It's like a massive haircut on their debt. Or they may be able to call Drahi's bluff. Assuming that Drahi wants to keep his equity position in the business, he probably wants to avoid a formal process, which may eventually at some point see him lose his stake in Altice France. But then the unsecured debt's definitely playing with fire, and they're at risk of, I suppose, getting nothing in return if Drahi decides to take the even more value out of the group and eventually run, I suppose, with the dividends. But as Freddie said, it's not 100% clear currently if they would be able to get the dividends out and to take that value away from what Chris called earlier, the wider insolvency group.
And as we look forward to what's going to happen next or may happen next, the sort of the unknowns of what's coming up, you know, should we, I mean, just giving a little bit of empathy to Drahi, has he taken some cues here from what happened with Casino? We're talking about the French process and, you know, with Casino, they were kicking the can down the road for a long time. And it eventually wound up with the owner losing his company. But are there parallels between the situations? And if not, Why? Why? How will this be different? Maybe let's go to Chris with that.
Well, I mean, I think the question here a little bit is one of timing, and we'll, you know, maybe Nathan can weigh in a bit on some of it. I think the first question is really there's the broader question of where the value breaks, but there's also a question of when the value breaks. So I think when you talk about kicking the can down the road here, I think the first things that we really are worried about from a repayment standpoint are some of the 2025 notes due in January and February 2025. With the proceeds of the Altice Media sale, I think there's pretty good comfort that they would be able to cover those. So I think the next debt that comes due is in summer 2025. So if we're thinking about it in terms of where we are right now, there's no issue in terms of them being able to cover any debt that would, quote unquote, be current here in the next few months. So I think it starts to come into probably a broader question for Nathan of where do we think some of the strength and leverage is between Drahi, the secured note holders, and the unsecured note holders. You know, it becomes a bit of a game of chicken, as you mentioned, right? Because, you know, maybe Drahi doesn't want to go into a formal process, put the equity at risk. But equally, the unsecureds right now aren't due until 2027. So they don't really have much incentive to take zero at this stage. So it really becomes, where do they kind of see the value they think they might have? And I guess that's why they're trading down so much compared to the secureds. But not sure if you want to jump in on that, Nathan.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like what you say, it's a game of chicken at the moment. If you're an unsecured creditor, you know, you either take a discounted buyback, heavily impairs your position, or you try to play the long game, wait until you're at maturity, and maybe you can force a process. But again, if performance doesn't really turn around for Altice France, and it doesn't look like it will do anytime soon, where you sit in the valuation of the group, it's not looking great. So I think creditors, if they don't want to be too aggressive, are inclined to take some sort of discounted transaction. I'm intrigued to see where that will end up falling and at what price, because essentially Drahi wants to deal with them at some point. But as Chris alluded to earlier, there's no immediate rush to deal with the unsecured.
But there is an element too here, right? If the goal for Drahi is to get leverage down as low as possible, if they were going to use some of this cash for buybacks, they get the most bang for their buck by taking out some of these unsecureds in terms of advancing towards that leverage target, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can probably do a discounted buyback and, I don't know, let's say 50 cents on the dollar versus the secured notes. They're in the money currently, only slightly impaired based on waterfall analysis. But if Drahi continues taking value out of the restricted group, this further impairs the secured group's security, if you'd like. And sort of the money they're entitled to and the value on the assets. So again, they're inclined to at least entertain some of the discounted transactions, because the same way Drahi's almost given the unsecured an ultimatum that he's just going to keep stripping value away from them, that value will also come away from the secured lenders and end up eating into their position.
Well, I mean, this is an interesting facet of this, and whether there's any cohesion across the two groups. I know there are people in both groups, but you know, I've definitely had comments from the secured people saying, what, you know, why should they take any hit? But what do you think about the sort of wider complex of Altice? You know, is the market going to demand higher risk premium across the complex, or are there short memories out there and does demand outstrip supply? Who wants to go on that? Maybe Chris, come back in on that.
I mean, in terms of wider market, I think one of the other things that's super interesting, and we were getting a lot of questions when, you know, people started to realize last year that there was probably going to be a liquidity issue at some point in the structure, is they started to look at Altice International versus Altice France. You kind of had a performing credit and perhaps a non-performing credit here in the comparison of, but they ultimately had the same final shareholder. And, you know, was there potential leakage from one to the other? I think, you know, what they ultimately do, I think that very much falls into that bucket we were saying of unknowns. I think the thing to flag is Altice International has a lot of the same flexibility that Altice France has.
Do you mean in terms of the unrestricted?
Yep.
Yeah.
And you know, part of that is both of those builder baskets go back to 2012 and 2014, respectively. And so they've both accumulated quite a lot of buildup. So if there are asset sales happening in Altice International, you know, query whether they create some of the similar flexibility if Drahi ultimately is kind of looking at both as a whole. You know, I think there's separate questions that Freddie might want to weigh in at some point about corporate benefits and how that would work in any sort of look back period, but we could see where that goes. I think in terms of dealing with Altice France explicitly right now, you know, one of the things that Nathan alluded to very much is the interplay between the secured and the unsecureds, and the mere fact that they have this capacity to really pull a lot of these assets out of the restricted group, and it removes a lot of the secured note holders' priority to the unsecured note holders. And some of that moves into an unrestricted subsidiary could be used as part of security for any sort of partial exchange offer for unsecureds to move debt. I think the other thing that really could stretch the different note holder groups, and Dan or Nathan, maybe you guys have a view, is, you know, we talked a bit about the 2025s. There should be cash. Do we think there is tension between some of the earlier dated note holders and the longer dated note holders that they'd kind of look at their position as a whole? Or do we think there are kind of holdouts for the 2025s that just expect to be paid in par because there will be cash for
Nathan,
it?
I'll let you go on that bit.
I suppose it's a similar position to Intrum at the moment, where you're seeing this dynamic between the short end and the long end of the curve. In this scenario, the 25s, their motives to hold out for par. I mean, you know, Altice have the liquidity with the asset sale proceeds, albeit they're sitting outside the unrestricted group at the moment. So they have the ability to do that. But then if you have any crossholders along the maturities, they may have different motives, as they may want to not see value stripped away from them if they're holding, you know, the 27s or 28 notes.
Okay, I want to get to talking about the contagion effect this is having in the market, but I think we should drill a little bit further down into some of the interplay between the different notes in Altice and some of the different interests here. Chris, maybe you can talk us through some of the things that, or some of the complicating factors around this, around different tenors and who's holding them.
Well, I mean, I think the first point is actually, you know, when we talk about the complicating factors, pretty much all the bonds that are out there, and, you know, query if some of the loans also have the same sort of covenant packages, are on the largely the same basket size covenant basis, except for some of these 2027s secured notes, which, while aren't the earliest maturing or the longest dated maturities, are actually the ones that were issued the longest ago. So if they were to take that out, it does free up more general basket room for flexibility for the company. Whether that's really a priority right now, given the flexibility they have to designate as unrestricted subsidiary and that basket is so big already, not sure it moves the needle a whole lot right now. In terms of, you know, the other question though, in terms of dealing with the interest rates, you know, Nathan, I don't know if you've got, you know, been speaking to anybody, but there is quite wide variety between, you know, some of these are into double digits, and some of them are much more in the 2.5% range. So I'm sure in terms of, you know, if they are struggling as a business and cash flow, that can have a big impact.
Definitely. And it's like you said, there's quite a wide range here. And if the company itself is penny pinching and being conscious of its costs and wants to preserve as much liquidity as possible, and it's going to entertain any of these buybacks, then I suppose, one, it would look at the price it can buy this debt back at. And then the next thing to look at what rate, because there'd be some sort of break-even analysis that you can do across the bonds, whereas, yes, you may be able to buy back one tranche at, I don't know, let's say 5 points lower than the other one, but what does the interest savings look like? Do they balance each other out? So there's also that dynamic at play here.
Great. And coming to this idea of contagion, I mean, we've seen from the CLO side, there's been lots of different viewpoints about what this does, especially on the triple C buckets and how CLOs address that. I've seen articles saying that there'll be sort of fire sales of other assets because they'll need to quickly sell them. We've kind of said that that seems less likely than people will probably look for better quality assets around the orbit, sort of nearer to par assets, and try to sell around the 95 level, not taking huge discounts because it's a broad universe. So we're not sure that that necessarily plays out. But what are you guys seeing on this front, and what do you think is the sort of likely repercussions of for contagion in the market? Chris?
I think that really veers into the kind of speculation. What is the wider contagion? I think it gets into this broader game of what is their kind of end game here. You know, the mere fact that Drahi on the call, or, you know, I guess management was able to kind of quite clearly state where some of these haircuts were coming, that they were looking to be bullish, and that this wasn't just a pain to be endured by some unsecured notes. I think it just probably has spooked the broader market in terms of what other aggressive position could they take to utilize that flexibility. I believe on the back of that, almost all the businesses that Drahi was ultimately a controlling shareholder for were trading down. So I think there was just almost this knee-jerk reaction, a bit of, look, if they want to be aggressive to deal with this situation, you know, is there a broad, as you say, a broader contagion to the other businesses? You know, how does that impact Altice International? How does it impact all the other trickle down effects of some of the debt that's out there?
And I suppose, what does this mean for loose stocks? We're seeing the end of loose stocks, which essentially allowed Drahi to do this to the bondholders.
I think the big question here for loose stocks is, I suspect that this builder basket, just in the fact that they had so much capacity to move all these assets out of the restricted group, caught people off guard. You know, there's one of these things, I was kind of talking to someone and they're like, well, was this super aggressive? You know, what did they change? And it was like, oh no, this has been the same terms pretty much since their first deal. You know, and when you talk about it and look at it, it's like, okay, well, the builder basket goes back to 2014. Why? It's like, okay, well, that's when they did their first issuance. So, and then they do another issuance a year or two later. They don't want to lose that capacity that they've already built up. The problem is then now you're 10 years on and you've got this huge built up capacity. The bond that was issued longest ago, I think, was only 2018. And they're still reaping the rewards and benefits of sort of capacity of how the business was performing from 2014 to 2018, when none of these bonds were even outstanding yet. How does that actually play out? Do people look to in terms of some of the bonds? I think people might be reevaluating it. Some of the terms we've seen more recently in the broader bond market are around some of these builder basket capacities. We've started to see people put in floors, quarterly floors, which can actually cause that basket to grow quite quickly. Traditionally, that basket was 50% of consolidated net income minus 100% of a deficit, which when you think about that, for a lot of businesses, probably isn't going to grow to a huge number. Here for Altice France, it was actually 100% of consolidated EBITDA minus 1.4 times interest expense. And when you kind of compare the two, you probably get the sense that the latter here for Altice France would grow a lot more quickly. And so while that sort of formulation is still a bit rare, we are starting to see a lot of the traditional 50% consolidated income basket. But what we are seeing are these floors coming in where actually they get to build the basket any good times and they don't have to reduce it in any bad times. And as these start to shift to potentially even on a quarterly basis, for certain seasonal issuers, you might see actually a lot more capacity built up into some of these baskets than people would from a traditional standpoint if you just thought about net income for a whole year. So our recent piece that we did talking about the trends we saw in 2023, the erosion of this basket was something we talked about. I think seeing how Altice France is utilizing this basket could create some renewed focus on it. Whether it continues to loosen or reverts back remains to be seen, you know, but a lot of times these type of events are what triggers a renewed focus by the buy side on some of these terms.
Yeah, and in that context, I mean, I think it's fair to say that there must be something slightly wrong if your first line of defense in terms of, you know, any distributions being made is directors' duties. It's not a particularly comfortable place for bondholders to be in.
Yeah, great. Yeah, agree with that. So as we come to sort of closing thoughts, we're going into kind of the territory of, you know, the speculation about what might happen. And do you have any sort of thoughts on that and where we're at? I mean, I know that we've been talking about the groups that are coming together and the pitches from financial advisors, you know, without speculating too much. What do you think is the next step and what are people going to be looking for in those approaches for the bondholders? Maybe Chris, you can start this off.
Well, I think the first question, and then we'll kick it over here to Nathan, is, you know, we kind of talked about how they could designate a lot of future assets and subsidiaries as unrestricted. There is a big difference, though, in terms of what their options are on whether they plan to sell those assets so that they'll actually get cash in hand to use for dividends or any type of tender offer, you know, deleveraging, or whether they just would look to designate them as unrestricted for a potential up-tiering, priming transaction on the secured notes. So I think, you know, when we think about it, you know, Nathan, I don't know, are there other assets that we think they might be able to sell and realize some proceeds within these timelines, or have they highlighted anything else?
I suppose you have the obvious one of XP Fiber, which has sat outside the restricted group for quite a while now, but that's the one that Drahi has almost pinned his hat on over the years and suggested is going to bring a lot of value forward. Based on management's estimates, I think it's expected to produce around 600 million of EBITDA in the midterm. And like most fiber codes, pretty much all of that will go to free cash flow. So there's a lot of value in that unrestricted subsidiary. So how management and Drahi himself may decide to, you know, use that to his advantage is an interesting one to keep an eye on.
Okay, and any other final thoughts anyone has before we sign off on this one?
I think the last thing I just flagged, Dan, is, you know, you mentioned XP Fiber, and I think one of the things is that was designated as an unrestricted subsidiary back in 2019 when they sold, you know, give or take half of it. You know, it basically became a bit of a joint venture. That's a bit of how this basket that's being utilized now was intended to operate, was to create some of that flexibility where if all of a sudden you have close to a joint venture that you don't want it to be bound by the broader restricted group's terms because the other shareholders in and needs to get its own financing, operate on its own business, be able to pay dividends to its different shareholders. You know, that's kind of the purpose. So it's one of those things, XP Fiber being designated as an unrestricted subsidiary back then kind of was utilizing this the way people expected. I think what we saw recently with Altice Media, which is then when they were just selling one of their assets, but then designated as unrestricted first, is what kind of caught people off guard. And that's why maybe back in 2019, when they designated something like XP Fiber, even though it was a sizable asset, as unrestricted, people didn't react necessarily the same way.
Yeah, and just one other point from me, I think, is just in the context of obviously Drahi and the management team generally on the earnings call were quite clear about the fact that there would need to be some form of holistic solution dealing with, you know, kind of all of the bonds. And so in that context, it seems possible, at least, even though because of the fact that Drahi is, I assume, quite keen on retaining his equity stake, that there'll need to be some form of non-consensual deal implemented potentially. The question then is, you know, where does it make sense for that to happen? You know, obviously all of the debts is issued by French companies, albeit mainly New York law, I think. The vast majority of the group assets are located in France. And obviously, it's a strategically and in terms of infrastructure, very important business for the French state. So I think it seems pretty clear that if there were a restructuring, ultimately a restructuring implementation tool used, it would need to be a French tool. You know, we mentioned Casino and Orpea earlier. They made use of the accelerated safeguards process, which is a new restructuring tool in the armory of France, which is in effect an implementation of the preventative framework for restructuring processes directive. And so it has really made the French jurisdiction in terms of implementing these restructuring processes a much more favorable place for creditors to go to and actually restructure their indebtedness. I think just cutting to the chase though on this, and without kind of going into the detail too much, is that the reason that Drahi perhaps won't be too keen on using this implementation tool, and so ideally not needing to do something non-consensually, is effectively that the absolute priority needs to be complied with in a French process, in this French process. And that's effectively that junior debt can't be paid back before senior debt. So that might be the tripwire here, and might be the reason that if they were to enter this process, Drahi wouldn't be able to retain his equity, particularly in circumstances, obviously, where unsecured creditors, which are underwater, are impaired or likely wiped out. It's worth just flagging, though, that the absolute priority rule isn't like an immutable rule. It can be deviated in certain circumstances where it's deemed necessary for the objectives of the plan to be met. But you can see a scenario where Drahi tries to assert that assets which have been taken out of the restricted groups, which are then, you know, whatever he does with those assets or the proceeds of those assets, ultimately then recontributes them to the group. He might then use that as an argument to say, oh, but look, I've given fresh incremental equity into the group. It's important that I do that for the purposes of the plan, and therefore I should retain my equity stake. Now, I think there's a relatively easy counter argument to that, which is basically it's not fresh incremental equity. It's in effect assets which were available were you know, within the credit box, which then subsequently went out of it. And also just touching on what Chris said earlier, it goes to this distinction between the restricted group and the kind of wider insolvency estate or the insolvency group, which is to say that in a counterfactual insolvency, those assets would be available to all creditors. And so, you know, using that as a reference point, it's hard to see how it could be an incremental contribution. So I think whilst that probably will be a bit of a battleground, I think it might be a bit of a difficult argument for Drahi to sustain.
Well, I think you've raised some interesting points about the nature of this, that we're talking about in sort of non-consensual situation. And it's obviously a very new kind of situation for the market. But is there any way this sort of ends up resolving to something much more recognizable? Is there a trigger for, you know, conciliation, mandate, appointment? And if so, you know, how does this come about, and what happens at that point? Maybe Chris or Nathan, would you like to talk about that?
This one might be one for me, actually. So unless Nathan, you want to win?
Yeah, far away, Freddie. All yours.
I think the accelerated safeguard process is the non-consensual process, which would be available in France. It is worth just mentioning that obviously there are a whole bunch of other processes which, you know, you can use in France. You mentioned the mandat. There's obviously also the conciliation process. I think the conciliation process is one probably to think about, because while I think that realistically a kind of holistic consensual deal which results in a debt for equity or some form of impairment is unlikely to get done consensually. The doxer will be 90% for money terms. It'll be difficult to do that, I would have thought, consensually. What a conciliation does is it provides the group effectively with a court-appointed conciliator who will facilitate negotiations. Now, the accelerated safeguard, which I described earlier, the kind of non-consensual process, if you like, the UK restructuring plan equivalent, it does actually require you to have done a conciliation for at least 4 or actually 5 months before you actually enter the accelerated safeguard. So I think, you know, however you do it, there will, if you do end up going into an accelerated safeguard, you will either way have to have done conciliation.
Excellent. Well, so much to think about there, and I think that's a good juncture to leave off with this one. So at that, I'll just say thanks for joining us. Please let us know if you have any feedback. You can reach us anytime by emailing podcast@ninefin.com. We'll be back next week for deeper analysis around the LT story. You already know where to get the most readable, informative news flow around the situation and all the others you care about on ninefin.com.